So 25 years ago, would you ever have imagined sitting in a room in Spain, looking back on your whole career?
You know, I tend to live in the moment, and I think probably one of the themes of this interview will be about just that, living in the moment, not really thinking much about the future or necessarily thinking about the past. You know, the great thing about music is it's very immediate, and then it's gone, it's over. So no, I didn't really anticipate this. I didn't anticipate becoming 60. I couldn't imagine being 60 when I was 25 or even 30. I'm glad that I'm my age. I'm proud of my age. I'm not hiding it. I think there's a certain amount of sagacity that comes along with it, you know, a bit of wisdom, not too much. And yet I don't feel physically like I'm that age. I don't feel infirm, you know. And I think my impression of people who were 60 when I was younger was that they were, you know, they just couldn't function as human beings, as physical human beings. And I feel very strong. So I'm fortunate in that sense. So it's fun. I have both sides of it. I have a bit of wisdom, and I still have, you know, the energy of a younger man.
How did it go down? The whole process for the Dream of the Blue Turtles and bringing that whole concept together.
I get bored very easily, and I just like to do a different thing every time. I'm not one of these guys who just want to keep pressing the same button, you know, to get the same results. Because I don't think you do. I think you get diminishing returns. I've always been a bit of a gadfly. You know, and some people would say that's not logical. You know, if you're successful, you have a formula here, then you should keep repeating it. And my rationale is the complete opposite. You know, once you know that works, then why do it again? And so I wanted to make the Dream of the Blue Turtles as basically an omnibus of different kinds of songs. And then I started to look for musicians to recruit, and I was in New York, and I met Branford Marsalis and Kenny Kirkland, who were jazz players. And I was intrigued by that. Not that I wanted to make a jazz record, I was just intrigued by people who wanted to cross over from one kind of music and who are broad-minded enough to see the possibilities of that, rather than you know, just sticking with jazz or just making pop music. To actually see if something could be created from both. My mom was dying when I was making this record, and she was obviously a sort of guiding spirit of the record, although not consciously. I didn't set out to make a record, you know, about my mother, but you know, obviously she was on my mind a lot and suffering a lot. And I suppose the record became a kind of therapy, a way of processing that. Those feelings. My previous successful song had been Every Breath You Take, which is kind of a song about control and surveillance, and you know, it's not a terribly healthy song. Although some people think it's very romantic. I won't disabuse them of that. Of course, you can interpret a song in whatever way, but there is some darkness to Every Breath You Take. So I wanted to write the antidote to that. Of course, if you love somebody, set them free. Well, I don't think I invented that phrase. I think it came from somewhere else, but it was the way I was feeling, you know? I wanted to be set free, and if you really love me, let me go.
Love is the Seventh Wave is a great example of a track where you brought calypso and reggae together. How did that all come about?
Well, we were on the island of Barbados, you know, and we go on every night to reggae bars, and so, you know, because in the water we were drinking, so we just did a reggae song. It's a sweet song.
What motivated you to write the track Englishman in New York?
Englishman in New York was inspired by a guy who became a friend of mine, Quentin Crisp. He was homosexual at a time where it was illegal in Britain and dangerous. And he was a very singular man, a very brave man, who dressed in a very flamboyant manner at a time when it was dangerous, and wrote about his life. And he wrote a book called The Naked Civil Servant. And then when I moved to New York, I sought him out, and I'd have lunch with him, and we'd chat a lot. And I wrote that song for him. You know, the line, "Be yourself, no matter what they say," I think it's one of his. "The Dance Alone" was inspired by an article I read in a magazine about the Pinochet regime in Chile. With the help of the CIA, you know, Pinochet had a military coup and had basically murdered a lot of people, who left-wing people, union leaders, intellectuals, folk singers. And a whole class of people became known as the disappeared, los desaparecidos. And there was no recourse, there was no legal recourse for these people, the survivors of these families. What they did was the mothers of the disappeared, or the wives or the children, would dress in traditional costume, and they'd pin the photographs of their loved ones to their clothes, and they dance this traditional Chilean dance called the cuica outside of government buildings, and of course were photographed, and you know, they created a great furore. And I learned of the whole situation through this article, and then I went to Chile and I met these women, and they told me the horrific stories of what had happened to their husbands and their sons. And the song became a bit of a cause célèbre in Chile. I think it was banned, understandably. But eventually I went back to Chile with Amnesty International and performed the song with the mothers on stage in the stadium where a lot of their kids had been murdered. So that was pretty, it's an intense performance situation as you're ever likely to get. Because everyone in the stadium knew what was being reenacted here. And dancing with these mums in this particular place was probably unforgettable. One of the moments that I think, well, what a privilege to be a performer, and you are allowed to do this kind of thing. And I have kept that relationship with these people. Every time I go to Chile, they come and see me. And you know, I just lost my own mother, so it was kind of a lot of replacement mothers sort of turned up. So there was a connection there. The Soul Cages, I started to think about an album just after Nothing Like the Sun, and my mum died, and then my old man died, and within a year of each other. So I was kind of in a bit of a state, really. I knew I had to write something, because that's always been my therapy, the way of processing emotion. And I started to think about where I came from. I'm from Tyneside, which is a very industrial part of England. And I was brought up in a very bizarre landscape, industrial landscape, in a street next to a shipyard. And one of my earliest memories is of massive boat being built above our house. It's so big that it would just blot out the sun, and then they'd launch a ship, and then they'd build another one. These ships, of course, would never come back. Once they'd been launched, they would leave, and that became very symbolic, I suppose, of my own life. Started writing about my town, and by association, writing about my dad and the death of my father, and the death of my town, really, because they closed the shipyard and they closed the coal mine, and a thriving community basically left to its own devices. So the themes on that record are kind of dark.
Tell me about all this time. What's interesting is that it seems that Bach played a big influence in that song.
Well, you know, I sort of fallen in love with Bach cello suites, and the first one particularly, and I was just messing around a guitar with those, the way it changes, and then it kind of evolved into a song, which you wouldn't, even the musicologist wouldn't see the connection. But that was the starting point, the way the chords move came from Bach, and then they evolved so you wouldn't recognize what it was. But, you know, That's how you start. You take something that exists already, and then you transform it into something else, and then you lose whatever the the original influence was, and it becomes something different. But I still find Bach a very useful teacher. You know, I try and play a little bit every day from the music, and there's an interesting thing happens when you play from music. You're almost in the same in the room with the guy who wrote 400 years ago, and you see him making decisions on the paper, and you wonder how on earth he figured that one out, you know. And it's like being with a teacher. So he's still very much a character in my back room.
Your next record was 10 Sumner's Tales. What's the story behind that record for you?
I decided to get out of the city. I've been living in London for a long, long time, and just wanted to know what it'd be like to live in the country, you know. And there's an atmosphere on that record that's very much about being at home in that house. We all lived in the house, all the musicians and the technicians. The studio was a dining room next to a kitchen. The windows were open most of the time, and I wrote the songs walking around the garden, or sitting by the river. It was pretty idyllic.
So in the track of Fields of Gold, you clearly are speaking of barley fields, and you know this is part of your environment at the time. But what does this mean to you, and what attracted you to write a song about that?
Well, you know, we're surrounded by barley fields. It's as simple as that. And again, I wanted to pay tribute to that idea of continuity in relationships and how important they are. And the song is a very sort of, it's like an old folk song, you know, and it uses tropes from old songs that, you know, have been around for years that no one can lay claim to as part of our heritage. But the song could have been written in the 16th century. You know, it wouldn't be much different to, but it has a meaning now, which I like.
Tell me about the track 7 Days.
7 Days is, I think, a funny song. It's perversely written in 5/4 time, whereas maybe 7/8 time would have been a little more appropriate. But you know, I like writing in compound time. It's like a puzzle to me. How do you fit standard rhyme into this very sort of strange meter? Some people get it, some people don't. But it's like a three-dimensional puzzle. I love the way drums keep looping around in this. Every time they come back, they're in a different place in the bar. That amuses me. Mercury Falling was again made at Lake House. There are some songs on it that I'm really proud of. Hung My Head, I'm very proud of that song. It was eventually covered by Johnny Cash, which made me very happy. You know, if you're writing a country song and Johnny Cash covers it, you're doing something right. Hounds of Winter, I like that song too. I like the way the chords move. And it's really a song about being an older man, reflecting on loneliness. It wasn't me at the time, but you know, you're allowed to role play. You're allowed to put yourself in the shoes of other people as a songwriter.
What's the meaning behind the track, Let Your Soul Be Your Pilot?
A friend of mine who was dying of AIDS, and I didn't really have much hope for him. I just thought I'd write a supportive song about what that situation would be like. Happily, he didn't die. It was one of those miracles. And but you know, the period before that, when people got AIDS, they were basically condemned to death. And happily now, people can have normal lives. But the song was about death and coping with it. I think it's an important subject, increasingly. Brand New Day was written just before the millennium, and there was a lot of millennial talk about the end of the world. You know, we had the Y2K scare, you know, the world was going to end. And I think sort of pessimism like that is kind of self-fulfilling in a way. So I wanted to write an antidote to that, saying, start again. There's a song called Tomorrow We'll See. The character that emerged from this music was a transsexual prostitute. And I don't know quite where he comes from in my psyche. But I went through with it, wrote the song in this persona of this person. And the refrain is, you know, don't judge me. You could be me in another another life and different set of circumstances, which I think is a good lesson. You know, we shouldn't judge people. The world is riddled with judgment, you know, and it's not helping. We need to be tolerant, and we need to understand each other and accept each other's differences. Desert Rose's song about spiritual longing, I suppose, through the filter of romantic longing. I gave it to Cheb Mami, who doesn't speak English. And I said, can you write some lyrics in Arabic that will be able to weave in and out of this, of my song? And he said, sure, you know. So he came back about a week later and he said, oh, I've got this. And he started singing. I said, what are you singing about? He says, oh, I'm singing about longing. So, I mean, it's not a big stretch really, but you know, it was interesting that we're both basically singing the same thing, even from different cultures. I felt for a time, in the aftermath of that event, September the 11th, that the United States had an opportunity. The world was very much with it, and in sympathy with it, apart from a few harebrained fanatics. And that was a very useful time for America to set a few things right. Instead, we ended up invading Iraq for reasons that have since been shown to be spurious. It made me angry, and I think a lot of the songs on Sacred Love were an angry reaction to that wasted opportunity. You know, for years I'd been propositioned by people saying that I ought to sing the music of John Dowland, and I could never figure out why this proposition kept coming to me. And it sounds a bit fruity, you know, this sort of 16th century music, very highfalutin. Never quite saw it. And then I met a lute player called Edin Karamazov. He's a fantastic lute player, but he lives in this world, this strange 16th century world, and said, you should learn the songs of Dowland. Okay, I'm tired of hearing this. Let's see what this is about. So he taught me some of the songs. It's one of those sort of labors of love that you just do for curiosity, and so I'm kind of gratified by that, and I hope John Dowland is, and he's not spinning in his grave somewhere, wherever he's buried.
In 2009, you released If on a Winter's Night. What made that record unique, and what was that process like for you?
This concept was brought to me by Bob Seddon, who's a very successful record producer, because I like the winter. I love the winter. And we started to look at repertoire, and at first some of the repertoire was a little bit obvious, you know, like Christmas carols that everybody knew. And I said, I'm not really interested in that kind of record. I want to do songs that people don't know. Esoteric songs, strange songs. I sang a couple of the songs in my dialect because I hadn't actually done that on record before. But and it's a dialect I rarely use unless I get angry. And so to use it for singing was interesting. But I kind of lost my accent in my 20s. When I moved to London and no one understood a word I said, I said, okay, I will learn a new language. But if I go home, I'll speak Geordie. Or if I get really angry.
You've been doing this for so long, it seems that you work so hard. Where does your work ethic come from?
I don't feel as if I'm existing unless I'm working. It's my raison d'etre. I'm not saying that's a particularly healthy attitude, but it's the way I am. I enjoy working, but when I'm not working, I don't know what my function is. I still think I'm a work in progress, you know. I still think I've got a way to go before I can stop.